Thank you for that introduction. My name is Ryan Pinson. I'm an assistant professor here at Arizona State University. So yes, I'm going to be talking briefly about the scalar drivers of diazotropes, but I also want to focus more on network analysis and also give a bit of an introduction for network analysis, so since I think that most people here at this conference haven't really been exposed to it that much. So our initial study wanted to look at scalar drivers. We all know that pH has been called the master variable for microbial community composition, but certainly it is not across different scales. So we're looking specifically at the diazotrophic community here. So these are free-living nitrogen fixers. They are not nodulating. However, they can contribute a significant fraction of nitrogen to an agricultural system. So to ask this question, we sample five different regions within Australia. These are five different agricultural regions. There are three different types of soil types. There are clay vertisols, there are sandy calcareous loams, and there are sandy soils. And we specifically targeted the NIFH gene for functional gene sequencing on the IonTorrent platform. The NIFH gene is the functional gene for nitrogen fixation. And we ended up with about 6,250 sequences per sample. Within each one of these different regions, we also looked at management, tillage versus no tillage, stubble retained versus stubble burned, as well as the addition of organic matter, the addition of fertilizer, and the type of plant that is grown within the agricultural field. So this is the one slide basically encompassing these results. This could easily be 45 minutes getting into this, but we obviously don't have that time. At the continental scale, what we found was that soil type was the major driver. So how we came upon that was through a combination of multiple regression tree analysis and the correlation of biological and environmental matrices. The matrices said that percent clay was the major driver of diazotrophic community composition, and that gave us a row value of about 0.72. When we added in other factors that are really proxies for soil type, such as bulk density, percent sand, pH, as well as continental scale drivers, mean annual temperature, mean annual precipitation, our row value went up to about 0.82, both of those being significant. So soil type appears to be the major driver that are shaping the communities of these free-living nitrogen fixers. Over here we have our diversity indices. Within our clay soils we have our highest diversity, that's followed by the calcareous sandy loam, and our lowest in fixing diversity is within the sandy soils. At the continental scale, again, we said the soil type was the major driver. When we go down to a regional scale, we find that management is a driver. There are large differences in diazotrophic community composition between till, no-till, stubble retained, stubble burnt, etc. At the field level, it really is the plant composition. Annual versus perennial plants play a large role in the composition of the diazotrophs. Even though these are not nodulating, they do have an intimate relationship with plant roots and are affected by the type of plants and the abundance of plants in the field. And finally, at the plot level, that's when fertilizer addition or the addition of compost, the addition of organic carbon, played a role in influencing the community composition, as well as influencing the quantitation of NIFH, which we did as well within this study. So over here you see a circle tree. This is the collection of our NIFH sequences. On the outer ring we have our sandy versus calcareous versus vertisols, the abundances. So you can see that some of these clades have a higher abundance in certain types of soils. Now if we step back, this is pretty much where most microbial ecology studies of composition end. Sure, we can throw in some NMDS, PCOA, CCA, something like that, and we have correlation, so that's great. We have correlation of flux rates. Perfect. In my opinion, over the past 15 years, microbial ecology has separated microbiology from ecology. As we have been sequencing more and more, everybody and their brother sequences now. And if you can sequence and correlate to one environmental parameter, that's great, if you have actually measured biogeochemical parameters, which many studies do not that attempt to be published. But what does this mean? The question is, so what now? Now we've discovered who is there in the microbial community, in the functional community, and gene-specific communities. We don't know what the majority of them do, because the majority of them cannot be cultured. But how can we get back to linking microbiology with ecology? Well, I think one way of doing that, at least as a first baby step, is utilizing ecological network theory. Now, this has been around for I'd say around 7 or 8 years now. It's starting to really become the new term and become popular in presentations and in publications. So we use molecular ecological network theory. This is based on ecological networks. So here's a very simple one. We have omnivores, we have herbivores, we have invasive plants, and we have native plants. Each one of these little dots around the edge of the circle indicate a different species within each one of those groups. Each one of these lines indicate an interaction. So we can see that herbivores are negatively influenced by the introduction of plants. So here we start to see relationships among community members. And we can do this with the microbial community. This can provide insight into some really terms that are, again, very sexy in today's world. Sensitivity, resistance, and resilience to change. So network analysis can help us to answer those questions, but it is very important that this is unproven experimentally. This is theoretical. We're working with Nanjing Agricultural University to try to both bioinformatically and experimentally prove, quote-unquote, some of these assumptions. So I want to correlate network analysis to building a house with some of the terms we're going to use. Number one are nodes. Nodes are individual OTUs. OTUs, in definition, in this study, are amino acid dissimilarity of 5% with the NIFH gene. I'm just going to call them species. That's incorrect, but as a shortcut, I'm going to call them species. The individual OTUs can be thought of as individual pieces of lumber when you're building a house. They have interactions with other pieces of lumber. Next up are the network hubs. Network hubs are very important in maintaining the stability of the network. They have a high degree of interactions with other species. And so if you were to take out a network hub, you would expect that many, many other connections are going to disappear. You can think of this as a load-bearing beam in a house. Maybe you have one, two, or three load-bearing beams. If you take out a load-bearing beam, what's going to happen? The house is most likely going to collapse. So functionally, that house is going to collapse, and that's what we would expect from the network, that we would have a functional collapse of this nitrogen-fixing community. Next up are module hubs. So a module here in the house could be thought of as the roof. The roof provides protection, you know, from the elements for the house. If you were to take out a roof truss, likely that roof is going to collapse. However, the entire house is not going to collapse, just the functional unit of the roof. And modules in the graph that you're going to see, a module represented by a circle. And these are a group of closely interacting bacteria, closely interacting species. Connectors are the wall framing. Surely they do play a role in the integrity of the house, but you can remove a bunch of those and still have the functional house present. The house will not collapse. And lastly, peripherals, the exterior plywood, they do play a role here in protection, but they have very little connections with other OTUs. So I said that the soil type was the main driver of diazotrophic community structure. So we're going to compare here the vertisol versus the sandy soil. Now, if we just step back and look at this, anybody can see that there is a topological difference here. The biggest being the connections and where the connections occur. In the sandy soil, we have a high degree of connections. We have a high degree of connections in between each module, within each module. Does that work? Nope. Versus the vertisol soil, where most of our connections are among modules. So if we think about this from an ecological context, in a sandy soil, nitrogen fixation occurs functionally only on decomposing roots and residues. A sandy soil is not well connected, microbial communities are not well connected, and so we would think that we're going to have spotty regions of nitrogen fixation. And that's what I think that this network analysis has shown us. Each one of these modules may represent a group of nitrogen fixers, different species, as I said, that are interacting on one decomposing residue. Whereas in the vertisol, a clay soil, more highly connected, nitrogen fixation is not just limited to these hot spots within the sandy soil. And so you have more competition between different groups of bacteria because of the higher connectivity. What's interesting here is that also within this nitrogen fixing community, the interactions are mostly negative. And this contrasts with the majority of studies that are currently present that show that negative interactions are usually between 9 and about 25%. Here we're up to about 73% negative interactions. So there is a lot of competition. And maybe that's because we're looking at a functional community instead of the whole community as a whole, or the community as a whole, this functional community is competing for substrates, is competing for space to perform pretty much the same function. Now, if we look at some of those definitions, we have our network hubs up here. The Vertisol has three network hubs. Network hubs are pretty rare to see in molecular ecological network analysis. These three network hubs indicate that we have some very important species that if you were to perturbate them, to take them out, possibly that entire network will collapse. In contrast, in the sandy soil, we have many module hubs. And this makes sense, again, since we are very modular due to this decomposing on these residues. So what does this mean? Well, this is where the ecological theory and the interpretation takes hold. A lot of this, or some of the basis of this, is based on bee pollination networks. But what we can say right now, from not only the topology of the network, but from the metrics that are output from network analysis, is that the Vertisol, with its higher diversity, is going to shift quasi-independently. So in other words, with an environmental stress, say it's tillage, say it's fertilizer addition, or climate change, you're going to have individual OTUs that are going to maybe be taken out, they're going to die, or they're going to change in abundance. They're going to do that quasi-independently. They're not going to cause a chain reaction of changes in other OTUs. There's going to be a more rapid response to change within the Vertisol, but there's not going to be a domino effect, and thus your community is not going to collapse. In contrast, the sandy soil, because we have all of these connections within each module, when you start shifting and or influencing one species, there's going to be a domino effect where many others are also influenced. And eventually a domino effect is going to take effect, and there's going to be a transitional threshold that is reached, and a community is going to collapse. Theoretically, this would be a functional collapse, right? So that nitrogen fixation would be drastically affected. Does this answer resilience? No, not within this framework. But maybe the sandy network is resilient, because we do know that the sandy type nitrogen fixation highly fluctuates with season, where we have a bloom of certain OTUs during certain seasons, and that happens year after year. Now, this is the same thing that we actually see with some of our other studies. This is a naturally disease-suppressive soil to Rhizoctonia solani AG8. Here we have a non-suppressive soil, same farmer, same fields, separated by a road, same management. This field can have up to 60% disease incidence, where the suppressive soil can have less than 3%, usually annually per year. These are fungal networks. What we can tell is that the suppressive soil is less sensitive to change, and the non-suppressive soil has essentially collapsed, where now it is very sensitive to change. And it may be this network complexity, this lack of network complexity, the higher sensitivity, which allows for pathogen invasion year after year within this soil. And the soil apparently has not been resilient to go back to its less sensitive form. We also see that with biochar amendment. If we have taken oxisol soil, these are in Hawaii under a Napier grass. If we take an oxisol and we add biochar, this is wood chip biochar, we actually increase, or the soil becomes less sensitive. It becomes more resistant to change. So in an ecological context, we may even frame this into sustainability. If a soil microbial community, this is the whole microbial community here, is indeed a function of soil health, then if that community can be stable year after year after year, no matter what perturbation is put upon it, then you would say that that soil is more sustainable. So all in all, network analysis, I think, is one way for our field to move forward in terms of a more ecological context. Certainly, we're going to have new methods and new analyses as we go forward. But I think it's time to move past who is there and ask the question, so what? And with that, I'll end, and these are my collaborators. This is a collaboration with Gupta Vadakatu, a longtime collaborator, friend of mine, at Australia and Cicero. Thank you.
Representative of scale and to be able to make
Sampling, I think, is one of the least appreciated things in sampling for microbial ecology, for sequencing studies. It's rarely done, in my opinion, correctly. In these fields, we had 16 random sites. Each one of those 16 sites had a subplot. Within each one of those subplots were four cores, and each one of those four cores were mixed. So we ended up with 16 samples from composite cores throughout the field to try to account for some of the spatial variability. However, and these samples are based on extraction from 100 grams of soil at a time. Okay, thank you.